that in some of the systems, that's with a single person who meets with me and talks about my needs and my knowledge and helps me improve my knowledge base. Other systems have moved to where that's virtual, and it can happen online, and it can happen at my convenience in a virtual learning community. So we've seen lots of evolution of those kinds of things if we get away from what Dr. Abelson would call the tyranny of the office visit, and pay for health and care and outcomes and not just for encounters. This is a little bit of a depiction of that same evolution and the journey that we've been on in trying to pay for care. So pay for performance, as we saw it, peaked in 2004 and 2006. We're doing less and less of that as we shift our attention more to the healthcare homes and to total cost of care. So those are increasing over time. The number of organizations that are involved in the healthcare homes has increased over time, and the number of organizations willing to look at total cost of care has increased over time. I think it's 7 or 8 different organizations we have right now with some component of what they'll get paid in a given year tied to their total cost of care. And that's and the percentage increases over time also.
Do you have the numbers of how these have, each of these have worked? Are we going to get in?
We'll get into a little bit. I didn't bring the full detail, but we do study this. So the thing we've done the longest has been the medical home. And so at the point where we stepped out of the way and started paying organizations to manage chronically ill people, we saw a great decrease in our costs because we weren't using any kind of a vendor or other services to do disease management, and we saw a continued improvement in the health of the individual. It wasn't a decrease in all services, and in fact, as you can see on this slide, there were more office visits and there were more prescription refills in those people who were in medical homes, but they went to the hospital less. When they went to the hospital, they didn't stay as long, and overall there was a decrease in their cost with at least the same health. And in fact, what we saw when we look at the Minnesota Community Measurement numbers is that those organizations that were doing this had higher scores in the Minnesota Community Measurement, for instance, diabetes scores, than the organizations that had not gotten to this point yet. So more office visits, more meds, better health, better compliance with practice guidelines was what we've seen as we've shifted to medical homes. It's a little early, and the numbers aren't big enough to get a sense for total cost of care, but we have every reason to believe that it's much the same kind of a change. Still contrasting, as Mr. Knutson did, the difference from the 80s. I think in the 80s, there were a number of insurance companies around the country that wanted those relationships to be more of a win-win. And they were dealing with people who weren't very experienced at taking risk. And so what we saw were win-lose kinds of relationships. If you approach total cost of care exactly the way Mr. Knutson described it, in full disclosure about information, a pretty good understanding back and forth of what we think a practitioner's cost basis is and what the practitioner and his or her group think is their cost basis, you can come to some point of understanding about where the performance risk is, separated from, as best we can, the insurance risk, because we're not looking at this point to transfer the insurance risk.
We've got all the actuaries.
It's only fair that we keep that part. But the performance risk is what we've looked to try to share as we go and give incentives around making it better, and information is the key. So we study that over time, both to get to a starting point about what the goals ought to be, but even after you do that, the more important part is what are the opportunities. So if a group is looking to say, how do we lower our cost of care, who are the highest risk patients, at least from what we know, using the tools that we might have that the providers don't necessarily have, and what can we tell them about what we think is the risk for any given patient getting sicker? You can do that on an individual basis. You can also look by disease and say, what are a given group's costs per disease state? And within that disease state, how do they compare with optimal or to average, and where are the greatest opportunities? So in this particular instance, if diabetes were an opportunity to lower costs, you could drill down into diabetes costs and get even more information about where those opportunities are to make some kind of a difference. And I know you can't read these, and there's not any identifiable or real information on them anyway. It's more illustrative. What we look to do then, as we are paying for the care, is to say, where was that goal? Where was that target? What's the difference between the actual performance and the target relative to what we thought it would have been? How's the quality, and how's the patient satisfaction? So we're not looking just to say we can lower the cost. We're looking to say, how do we optimize that person's health or that populations of people, their health collectively over time? How do we measure that, and how do we share the improvements in those?
Dr. Fazio, have you made it to the point where you are sharing savings, experiencing savings, able to demonstrate those savings and sharing those savings with the clinics that are participating?
The short answer is yes. We have gotten to the point where we've reconciled the first couple of these agreements, and as we get to year end each year, there's a greater number of agreements and a greater percentage of total cost that's at risk. And I think, again, that we're working in what providers would describe as a win-win disclosure of as much information as we can as we move forward on these. I tried to put together some thoughts about the policy issues or the design issues that go along with this. I think information is critical to these kinds of considerations. So if you're the entity looking to contract with a delivery system, then having the delivery system understand their performance over time, the bumps in the road on that performance, any kind of outliers in that performance is really important. But every bit as important moving forward are the opportunities that are within whatever the population is that's under contract to try to make the care better. So I think the care system information is important. I think the other information that's important is in the referral system. So the work that's been done around the community on the peer grouping, I think to watch that over time, to watch how that supplements the information that's already in Minnesota Community Measurement, is important for us as some of those providers, especially the providers who aren't in integrated systems, look to decide where their referrals go. I think it's interesting in healthcare how little information we have on the performance of the people who practice their trades within healthcare. And it's also more interesting now as we get into total cost of care contracts that providers are coming to us wanting to know what we know about the efficiency of specialists, because it's very much in their interest now to know who the most efficient specialists are as they look to make their next referral. I think it also repositions baskets of care differently than it's been before. I think when we looked at packages or baskets of care previously, it was maybe a concept that the consumer didn't tag on to right away or identify with. But I think it's something that providers, especially providers at risk for total cost of care, are going to find very interesting, especially if their system doesn't provide the service defined in the basket. Because now all of a sudden, it's very different. As we hear providers describe the experience of an evolving total cost of care relationship, it's more about quality and efficiency, and it's less about encounters. So how much information can we gather about efficiency and quality? Flexibility in design, I think, is critical. Again, Mr. Knudsen talked about the fact that these things are evolving. It's not an on and off kind of a thing, and I don't know that too many of the relationships we have in place right now are the same. Organizations have different readiness to take on risk. They have different readiness to implement change, and we've found it important to allow that to happen at the pace that they can do it. We'd like to be encouraging without being, you know, too pushy about all of this, and to prescribe that there's one way to do it, I think, gets in the way of some of that change. Much of what we've done 3 years into it is becoming more standard and more reproducible, but I think the flexibility in the design is critical as people begin to take this on. Measurement of a constant population over time is important. Everything I've described to you, we do in our public programs as well as in our commercial book of business, so the pay for performance, the medical home, the total cost of care. Total cost of care gets a little trickier when you try to track a population over time some of the public programs. So enrollment issues and that sort of thing to sort of keep track of somebody's performance. And then I think we'd be hard-pressed to say that everything that is in the hands of the providers, even in systems that are redesigned. And so I think to the extent that we look at benefit designs, too, that encourage health and wellness and participation on the patient or enrollee side is also important as we look at this.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Abler?
Thanks. Just letting both these conversations rattle around my head. And I keep coming up with the same kind of questions that I've been asking for a couple of years. The admission, as we manage and find more efficient ways, is that there's been a bunch of waste and valueless care that's gone out, and some knew it and some didn't know it, and some people have built entire empires on, you know, capturing part of that waste into their clinic system. And so now they don't get the money. At least that's the hope, is that we can just have proper amounts of care to all people. And so, but how, in the real operation of all this, do you capture a good clinic that was doing everything correct, and they already did, they were focused on outcomes even when they didn't, even when it wasn't popular, as opposed to services, and they always tend to be very frugal and have really good stuff, and so you establish their baseline, and you say, now we're going to save some money, and there's not much to extract out of that one, and so yet you have a target or something. And the other group, which is a group that's been very spendy and very lavish with their work, good documentation because they have staff and they can document all this, and they can prove the value of all this, or in some as provable as it can be. And so to extract 10% out of that group by somebody who's a good manager and identifies inappropriate care is pretty easy. And so operationally, how do you get to that point? Does that make sense to you? And we're not going to solve it today, but could you just please comment about that?
Dr. Fauser?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I think it's a great question. So there are some groups that have a greater potential upside than other groups when you look at certain components of care. Within any given organization, I would say that some of the practitioners here would say they even have lines of service that have a greater upside within the same organization than other lines of service. So there are opportunities even there to do things differently. We've tried to focus more on that potential upside and how close we can get to optimal care. So it doesn't get at the issue of somebody having less to take out. We can address that, I think, through other kinds of contract mechanisms. And then I guess I wonder if, from an insurance benefit point of view, if there isn't a steerage opportunity for the most efficient systems through insurance benefits.
Steerage?
Through tiering benefits. So shouldn't there be some reward, some encouragement to use the most efficient system? So those systems that are already very, very lean, should they not show up as somehow featured in a benefit system?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Representative.
And I appreciate that. I'm convinced, having been a provider for 31 years in this, on the conservative wing of all this, and watching extreme waste go on that happens in many cases before they get to me, and as the system extracts with some glee all that they can out of my tiny pot of care, yet allowing for scans and all kinds of lengthy sessions that go on, and I'm trying to be a part of the solution here, but I think as you get to the point where you start taking some real money out of a group, be it a hospital or a large clinic system or even a regular clinic itself, that it sounds awfully easy. I guess it's, how are you going to bell the cat, but that's what has to be addressed, when you have all these meta-analysis and all these contracts, and at the end of the day, it's the provider choosing how they're going to function, and the patient cooperating in that, and there's different incentives in clinicians. There's some that understand that they got the math figured out. And there's some other people who are in the Peace Corps kind of individuals. And the middle ones who actually want to make a living that are just kind of sensible, you don't have to do much to them anyway. You just kind of encourage them, and they do great. The ones that are the way over chargers, the way over utilizers, they kind of like the money, and their system that they're in realizes that they're a profit center. No. Anyway, so maybe I'm being rhetorical, but I if we don't get at that, you're going to do all this stuff, and we're still going to have, you're going to have some of the lower providers drop out, and you're going to have the survivors be the ones that are more expensive. So that's just, I don't know where to go with that today, but I just wanted to bring it up again. And I thought it'd be a different way to repackage it for you.
Dr. Fazio?
Chair and Representative Weber. A couple thoughts. One of the best performing systems in our total cost of care arrangement is not vertically integrated. It's, for Minnesota purposes, relatively small family practice group that's done a great job of implementing change and finding those people with whom they want to work on a regular basis that are good quality and efficient. And they've done a great job both in their total cost of care and in their quality scores as they've changed this. So I think it is possible even for the smaller groups. I don't pretend that anything we're talking about is going to fix the system real soon. So we're not going to give up looking for the people who go on some of those billing adventures that you described, because we think we still have to find some of those. But I also think people are thinking about this very creatively. The person I had breakfast with today is looking at developing a small network of chiropractors that will partner with one of the ACOs as first source of treatment for back pain, because the family doctors in one of these clinics doesn't do a very good job with acute, uncomplicated low back pain. So I think people are thinking about the system very, very differently than they have before, even more differently than we're used to thinking about things even in Minnesota.
Representative Bunn and then Representative Hartley.
Thank you, Dr. Fazio. Going back to your chronic care management pilots, could you share with us approximately how much net savings you extracted from those pilots and also how you expect that to compare with a medium-term, more full-blown system for doing this, if you're willing to?
It's a good question. The most definitive information is on the chronic care pilots.
Mm-hmm.
Per member per month change in costs was never less than the $40 to $50 range, and often got into three digits change from an age risk matched control population, and you know, just some differences about those populations and how they were managed and what resources were used. It's not enough. I don't think the numbers are big enough, nor the at risk pool big enough to talk with any certainty about the total cost of care arrangements yet.
Mm-hmm. Could you follow up with your figure per person per month for the chronic management? What percentage roughly is that, the 50 to 150 per month savings? Because I don't know what your base is.
Sorry, I don't.
Okay.
It's probably over the whole range, it's probably 8 to 15% change.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Fazio, I think I know the answer, but what percentage of your enrollees are in some form of medical home in the metro area?
Representative Huntley, in the metro area, if you have a chronic condition, then between 70 and 80% of our members are in an organization that does the medical home in their clinics. Now, not 80% of our members have the need, but 80% of the enrollees are being seen somewhere where they could participate in a medical home.
Representative Huntley.
And how do the smaller clinics in the metro area, let's say they need to send somebody out to a gastroenterologist, which they don't have in their own group, and virtually all of the gastroenterologists are in one group, in a, except for those that are, you know, part of Fairview or part of Alina. All the independent ones are basically in one group. Can they negotiate a price with those people, or would they have to go see if they can get a better price at, say, Fairview?
Representative Huntley, I think the not too many of the way the reimbursement works, the provider would not typically at this point have a contract with another provider group. So the patient has their benefits through a health plan or through a self-insured employer, and the health plan or the self-insured employer through their administrator is using a whole set of contracts. So the contract that somebody from Onamia uses when they come to the Twin Cities to see a gastroenterologist or an orthopedist, whether that person's at Alina or Fairview or in one of the specialty groups, is still through whatever health plan that person had most typically, or through the state if it's a state employee or state-funded care.
Well, Mr. Chair, and then how does that clinic get the coordination of care that they need with the specialty group or the other group if they're a completely independent group that wants to do a great job with a medical home, but they obviously have to send their patients elsewhere once in a while?
There's two aspects to that. One is the more traditional clinical relationships. So how do I develop the referral network that I use as a practitioner? And sometimes it's based on experience, sometimes it's based on where I trained and who I trained with, and sometimes it's just based on anecdote. And what I hear the community calling for more is the ability, when they want to make that based on data rather than those other factors. The cost relationship is something that, again, at this point, the providers are starting to ask for information from the health plans. So we have a version of an efficiency report that we can develop for a cardiologist or an orthopedist around certain aspects of care, or a gastroenterologist around care of a chronic condition, or just to perform a procedure. We already have some of that information out on a website, Main Street Medica. So there's some information available more on an individual service level, and providers are asking for more episodic kinds of measurement, combined efficiency and quality. So it isn't typically about the negotiated price or having that contract in place as much as it is about the information for the care.
He's got to leave.
Yeah, do you good?
I'm done.
Okay. Ms. Sonier?
Mr. Chair, the question's a great one about critical mass, and actually there's, I think, two different parts to that. One is a critical mass from our side as a payer, and then I think the providers would speak to the same issue. I'll go with the payer side first. We can easily do this on our fully insured and all of our government-funded business, and then we have to include the self-insureds as they are willing to do this so that we can do those calculations and figure out how we make those adjustments in their experience without ever having to return money to them, which they just hate after the fact when we think about doing that. So that's a little bit of a trick, but we can get to the mass even if we just use fully insured lives. From the provider's point of view, if you are living in two worlds, it's very difficult. And again, this is what people describe to me. And so if you jump into the world where you're looking to be as efficient as you possibly could be, you could innovate yourself sort of out of business if the rest of the market doesn't come with you. all those admissions you are preventing are currently a source of revenue.
Right.
And so what to do with empty beds and or empty space and or lost revenue is critical. And I admire the systems that have jumped into this and done it despite the fact that we're just getting to the change in payment mechanisms.
We've got Dr. Schofester.
Thank you, Dr. Fazio. I'm intrigued by the opportunity that you have in watching with your providers their evolution and kind of paying attention to how they feel about that, how they react to what they tend to get excited about as they get better. Another piece of it that I haven't heard us talk about yet is the impact on the patient or consumer. And what I'd be interested in having you kind of say what you've learned is, in my current world, I'm just one little cog, and they may or may not come to me, and they may or may not be happy with what I decide, but they often tell me what they really want, and I try to figure out how to respond to that and make sure they come in so I get paid as I'm responding, which is that visit thing. And in the future world, what we're kind of talking about here is how that will evolve so that it's in my best interest and the system's best interest and the insurer's best interest that we use efficient, high-quality people, which may or not be what the patient wants. And so what I'm wondering is, how is their reaction to the system evolving, and what works best? At least I'm interested in the provider's perspective to help them to evolve in this efficiency thing.
Dr. Fazio.
What a great question, Mr. Chair. And George, great question. I think those who will follow have better experience than I do firsthand to talk about it. What I can tell you is that which we have measured in those systems that are early adopters of different kind of ways of delivering care, patients love it, those patients that have embraced it. I mean, we still have patients who want to be very traditional in their approach to the system and want everything to be in the course of a visit and would rather just keep on the medical side of things and the traditional visit medication side of things. We see some of that. But I think every bit as frequently we see patients who love the idea that care might not require a trip to the office, that somebody called to ask how they were doing, that somebody called and said, I'm a healthcare coach, what are you ready to work on? So those things coming at it differently, we've had good feedback so far, and I suspect the systems have more.
Ms. Carroll?
On to both of those?
Yeah, please.
On the first one, on the living in the two worlds piece, I just want to say that part of what our learnings were is that I remember that movie Network where, you know, you snap the pencil and we just don't want to take this anymore. I think that's sort of what happened with my CEO a couple years ago, that we looked at our negative, where we were going with Medicare, with Medicaid, and the dollars aren't going to be there. That's the reality. And if we don't change the system, we within the system, that it was going to happen anyway. So we have to jump to the next S-curve is sort of the reality of what Charlie's talking about. And that we're taking this leap of faith that there is a better way to have higher quality, better outcomes, and still reduce costs. And that was our charge and where our bent is going and the relationship that we've had with Medica and the other payers. It is paying off. It's not necessarily monetarily, but it's going in the right direction. It is difficult living in both worlds right now. And I'm excited for when we finally jump into that next world and how that's actually going to work. But we can't sustain where we are anymore.
Right.
I mean, you know what you're facing as you're walking into next year from a legislative perspective. We do, too, in the volumes that we have from Medicaid. And then I think about what our volumes are for Medicare. It keeps me up at night. And then what the private sector is saying to us, too, is reduce costs. Well, we got to figure out a better way, and that's really what we've been working on. And to answering your question, George, is it has been absolutely so rewarding to hear what patients are saying, and what we're doing is case studies with them, you know, pre, mid, and post their experience. And I think about what we're doing down in Eagan. patients, I think, would kill us if we went back to an old model at this point, because they so love the total care that they're getting, or the relationship, you know, Representative Huntley, that you talk about with the medical home. They feel safe. They feel like they're well cared for. They love talking to their nurse practitioner, or if they've got, you know, a better relationship with their doctor. And how we've set that up has just been, it's been working so well. And that's more data that we need to ascertain. And I think that will continue to evolve out. And as we share more information with the actual beneficiaries, that's what people are going to get excited about. And they're going to forget about, you know, the negative things that people sometimes articulate, that we need to get to true health care reform rather than focus on the good things about health care reform. So it's working. It really is.
Mr. Scandrett.
Thank you. And Dr. Fazio, thank you for, I know you've been working on this for a long time, kind of ahead of a lot of other people. So I think your hard work is really appreciated, and a lot of lessons here to learn. The question I have for you is that not all patients and groups of patients are the same in terms of the ability to work with them, their ability to follow a course of treatment and respond to treatment. In particular, if you have people extreme poverty or with serious mental illness or cultural language barriers and so forth. How are you thinking about, as the risk of the provider increases, what is going to prevent providers from selecting the patients based on those that they're going to have the best quality outcomes and be able to achieve the lowest cost of care? And is there a way to create incentives that will actually have providers really trying to figure out how to go out and find the patients who have those additional challenges and serve them well, because they'll get more reward than they do under the current system?
Yeah, I mean, I think the trick is to let the benefits accrue to the entity that's providing the cost savings within the system, and it's always really difficult to set it up. I mean, that seems to me the crux of what we're getting at. Dr. Fazio, you have some?
Mr. Chair, I think there's a few things here. I think patients tend to choose where they want to get their care for the most part. And we think that the risk adjusters are getting better, as well as some of the creativity around how to deliver care. So if I see the provider groups not thinking about the office or the hospital as the only place there needs to be care. I see a lot more care being done in homes and trying to keep people, especially the highest risk people, in their homes as care plans sort of evolve. I see different approaches to the highest risk populations, some of which started with the health plans around some of the public program and government funded populations, and others that have started in the delivery system. So The risk obviously is always there, but I have not yet seen the practitioners say that they'd shy away from any people who sought care in a system, and we're doing our best to change the payments and change whatever supports that we have to help accommodate that kind of care. I don't know that I can be much more specific than that. Yeah.
Can I do just a quick follow-up? In your risk adjustment method, does that include a consideration of non-clinical factors that would affect the cost of care or the outcome, such as, you know, income level or language barriers or other?
Mr. Chair, they're not that sophisticated.
They're just clinical. Okay.
Mostly clinical. They're evolving so that they can incorporate more information that we get about lifestyle, risk, and some of those other sort of demographic kinds of factors, but they're not quite there yet.
Well, Dr. Fazio, I know we took you beyond the time limit you said you had, and thank you for being so generous. And you're part of our group, so if we have further questions, Dr. Fazio will join us again. Thank you again.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
And we'll go to the Allina Health System, Maggie Hosbrook and Penny Wheeler. Or is Penny not?
Dr. Wheeler's not able to make it.
Okay.
Hi. Do you know where
Better luck than the last one.
Should be at the bottom.
Should be
on
there.
There it is.
Whoops.
Okay. All right. Well, while he gets that set up, good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Meg Hasbrook. I'm the Vice President of Contracting and Reimbursement at Alina Hospitals and Clinics. Can everybody hear me? Okay. Let me begin by saying that we understand that fee-for-service is unsustainable, and I think others have spoke to that, the breaking point. We know we need to do something different, and I think to your question at the beginning about talking about where we go with this group, we need to do something different, so I think we need to figure that out. At Alina, care comes first, and so we've been spending the most recent years focusing on measuring, reporting, and improving care quality, patient care safety, and patient experience. But we now are focusing also on affordability. It's kind of a new term for us. It's now, you see it in our strategic plans, and this is part of the culture change that we need to do. So affordability for patients, we're looking in our plans, affordability for payers, for health plans, and including government payers. Today I'm here to spend a few minutes to talk about our experience in attempting to balance care, patient experience, and affordability. So I'd like to first make sure that we're all speaking the same language. And this, maybe you've seen something like this before, but this is a continuum of payment models. On the left-hand side, is the fee-for-service, which we're all quite familiar with, where you're paid, you know, for each unit of service, and the higher intensity of that service, the higher payment. And value payments are really the rest of the models on this continuum, where we're paid for outcomes such as quality of care, the patient experience, or cost of care. These models include risk in that it's performance risk, in that our payment is contingent upon meeting certain performance targets. Usually these value payments are used in combination with fee-for-service. And I know I had a board member recently ask me, well, when will we be done with fee-for-service? And I think even when we're in, you know, if we were in full capitation, you know, we still will use some sort of fee-for-service model within our system as an accounting mechanism. So, you know, that's probably never going to go away.
The billing system.
The specific value models that we're talking about here, and there are many others, but pay for coordination, pay for performance, episodic payments, shared savings, and then capitation or population health. And our approach at Alina has been to phase in performance risk. And we've done that by first moving from pay for performance on process measures to outcome measures, and then expanding how much revenue we have at risk for pay for performance. And we also look in the value payment models to ensure that the triple aim, that we're not just focusing on affordability, but we're looking at how we balance all of those, that they're patient-centered, evidence-based care, and that we recognize care across the continuum, preventive and end-of-life. We'd like to make sure that we continue to be innovative. One of the things, and this is, I think, where you can see under episodic payments that we're really not doing a pilot right now, and that has to do with the fact that we're, as we look at pilots, we want to make sure that they're administratively simple, or at least not adding more complexity, whereas bundled payments or baskets of care add a lot of complexity. Health plans can't pay for them right now. We don't really know how to bill for them. And then also, so along with that, standardization. And then, as others have said earlier, we want to make sure that the benefit strategy is integrated with the payment model, and that that it inspires patients to have healthy behaviors and that aligns incentives with the provider and the patient together.
Ms. Hasbrook, the triple aims again, just go through the three.
Okay. Triple aims are patient care, the quality of care, the patient's experience, and then affordability or cost of care.
Thank you.
Oops, let me back up a minute. And so you can see the reform pilots that we have below that we are involved in right now. The Alina Medical Home I'm going to speak to today, and I think some of you have heard others talk about our healthcare home model, and we are hoping to be certified very soon. We, again, do a lot of pay-for-performance with all of the major payers, the CMS with the value-based purchasing, and we've been recognized recently with Bridges to Excellence. On the far left, the capitation, we really do little capitation right now, a few government-type products, but are like MSHO-type products. And even with our Heart of New Ulm pilot, that really isn't capitation, but it could be. You know, we're looking at working at a specific zip code, a community, and trying to improve their health by reducing or eliminating heart attacks. And in that, and again, I don't have time to speak about that project today, but, you know, we're improving their health all the way around. We're seeing diabetes go down, rates of improvement in diabetes. We're seeing obesity improvement, all kinds of things as a part of that project. What I really want to talk about today is the shared savings model, which is also called total cost of care model when Dr. Fazio spoke to it, and other people also call it ACO or an accountable care-like model. Pilots. One is called the Northwest Metro Alliance, and the other one is with Medica. And today, I'm going to speak to the Northwest Metro Alliance just briefly. This is a collaboration between Mercy Hospital, Alina Medical Clinic, Health Partners Medical Group, and Health Partners Health Plan. And it is focusing on a specific geography where we really are trying to improve, the health of a population. And it is triple aim focused again, which is optimizing health, the care experience, and the cost for a population. And the two key pieces, this is a multi-year complex arrangement that we have, but I'm focusing on more of the technical pieces in terms of the contract, the payer part of the contract. We have a withhold, and the withhold has three components to it. A patient experience component, a quality component, and an affordability component. And that is returned to the alliance if we achieve the goals that have been set. And so then we also have a shared savings component to this. And so this little chart here, I'll try to explain. The top line is, and this is really just for illustration, this isn't actual because we're really at the beginning of this partnership and I have nothing to report yet on that. But the top red line is projected trend, or it could be, it could be your own health system's projected trend, it could be Metro projected trend. But so you have your healthcare cost trend going up. You set a target below that. And again, the way this works is the affordability component of the withhold, we get back if we bend our total cost of care trend and hit that blue target. Where the shared savings come in is when you, between the blue line and the green line. So this would be a really successful demonstration where the care system, the green line, really bent the trend beyond what they were expecting and beyond the target. So the savings between the blue line and the green line are then returned in a proportion back to the provider system. So this is kind of technical, but I thought this might be, you know, it might be getting into the weeds a little bit, but helping you understand how we've set this up. As I said, we're at the beginning of this partnership, so we don't have actual results. Some of the specific actions that we are taking with this new partnership to try to be successful are we jointly hired a director so that could focus on this work and not have another day job. Mm-hmm. And that's been very important. We've also created joint committees with Health Partners Medical Group and the health plan. And we have a steering committee that oversees all of the work, but then we have subcommittees that are focusing on some just on the experience and care piece. Some are data mining, and they're looking at cost opportunities, and we try to get those two pieces together and then feed up to the steering committee. But I can tell you it's a lot of work. It's very time-consuming. It's new kinds of skill sets. It's a culture change. And, you know, I think earlier someone talked about what, you know, where's the tipping point or what kind of volume do you need in this model? You know, we have more than 90% of our revenue comes fee-for-service right now. More than 95% probably comes fee-for-service. So even if you were to put at risk your increases that you expect to get every year for the next 5 years, you're still going to have such a huge amount of your base payment that's fee-for-service that's not at risk. And so we really have to do something much different than this even to get change. The other part about this is if we do this just with one payer, most provider systems will tell you they don't treat patients differently, and we don't. And so the other payers will benefit because we will be bending the trend with Health Partners, but, you know, Blue Cross will benefit. So it really does, I think, need to be done as a community. Oops. Lessons learned. The total cost of care model does align incentives better, health plans and providers, both working toward a common goal of delivering efficient and effective care. But learning that getting the right balance, and, you know, this is pretty predictable, that the health plan is going to be more interested in affordability. They're representing their employers well. And we are more interested in ensuring that the patients have the right experience and the right care. So getting that right balance in incentives and withholds and shared savings is challenging, but at least we're all talking about triple aim. Data sharing, which Dr. Fazio spoke about, is essential and to target the opportunities for better performance on these triple aims. And the health plans have differing interpretations of current Minnesota statutes guarding patient information. And so we get different responses and different detail of claims data from the payers. But I think they will all tell you that they would like to give us more, but they feel that they can't. And we can't do more without getting at that more detailed claims level. So that is a barrier that we're seeing right now. Total cost of care and ACO-type contracts need to be a long-term commitment. To shed years of fee-for-service mentality, to develop new skills and new ways of thinking, and also the clinical initiatives may not be, and actually we're seeing many of them will not be recognized in this first year. We think we'll look very unsuccessful. So, but we think maybe in 2 or 3 years, what we're doing this year will start showing up in the total cost of care data and in some of the other work that we're doing. So they really need to be multi-year commitments. The next lesson about the market needing, I kind of talked about this, majority of payers need to be paying this way to provide enough momentum And also, we need a standard way to be using risk adjusters and including some of the adjusters that you talked about around income and language and some of the other barriers that are hard to adjust for, although I think I've heard you talk about some of some of the models that maybe we could use. So that's really important. I think we should do that as a community. It's hard work. We don't want to all go off in a different direction. And outlier definitions. And another barrier, I think, is, and these kind of go together, attribution method and the last one, which is health plan product design. I know there's a backlash from the 80s, and yet, if we have such an open access market, it's pretty hard to manage the patient that you don't know is attributed to you until after you got the data that said it was attributed to you. So to have patients enroll with a medical home, they become your partner in care, and I think we'll be a lot more successful if we start thinking about how we design benefits differently. And this slide we just threw on to talk about what does it take to be an effective in the ACO world, and I think this goes to some of the comments made earlier about readiness. So, you know, most literature will list these things. You need effective primary care at your core. You need integration with specialty care. You need clinical excellence and consistency. You need to coordinate and manage the care across all those transitions. You need technical support to measure and report on it, both the quality of the care and the cost of care. And you need infrastructure and skills to manage the financial risk. And then you need to align incentives within your organization. Maybe you need to change your comp model. And you need patients actively engaged in their care. Well, I can tell you that, Alina, our organization probably, we're pretty well developed, and we have some of these things. We're building and buying some of these things, and we still have gaps. So, the readiness issue is a big one. I think it's we have a ways to go, and it needs to be considered in terms of what we decide to do. So we're on this journey. We have more to learn and more to share, and I can take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hosbrook. Any questions?
Jim Ryman. Yeah, Meg, one of the questions I have for the Northwest Metro Alliance, what's the size of the population? Because I see varying degrees of whenever the literature looks at ACOs that you have to have a certain size population. What's the size of the Northwest? Do you have a ballpark or know what that?
I want to say it's about 25,000.
Wow, okay. That's a nice size.
But I can get back to you on that.
Okay.
Mr. Scandrett.
Yes, Meg, thanks for the presentation. And I'm looking at the bullet on coordinating and managing across all settings. Have you found that patients for whom non-clinical services, such as social services, housing, or other county services might be pretty important to the treatment and the outcome, and how do you deal with coordinating outside of the medical system?
That's one of our toughest ones, this whole coordinating and managing. And, in fact, we started to do an assessment in a line of where who has a title of care manager? And I think we had, over 100. And none of them were doing the work that I thought they should do, which is the work that health plan care managers do, because I focus on the health plan contract. Some of them are doing that, Michael, working on the transitions to home, and those might be more the social workers at discharge planning in the hospital. Now, we may not have those in the ambulatory setting. We have a variety of care navigators, and we're working on having kind of a hub with our home care and palliative care and hospice in terms of how we might manage all of this. But that is a big gap for us, and it's probably one of the most, it's the key to making this work. And I wanted to point out for this audience on this, it brings to mind this continuum, the CCDS I see on the other side of capitation. You know, the risk that you're having and the way that was structured is not even on this continuum.
I could ask one more question then, too. Do you know what percentage of the people that are enrolled in the pilot project have a mental illness along with their medical conditions?
In the Northwest Metro project, I'll say it's a majority.
Yeah. Okay.
It's not as high as a CCDS population, but yes, a majority do.
Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Do you know if anybody is doing pilot projects in the communities of color? We have such huge health disparities here in Minnesota, and I sure hope someone is looking at the communities of color and seeing how we can get those communities right out here in front of this big change that we have coming. And so many times I think, you know, they're an afterthought, and they really should be up front, especially on something like this.
Yes. You know, we have a project called the Backyard Project, which is to provide and improve the care for 1 mile square radius of Abbott Northwestern Hospital. And I can't really give you the update on that, but I can tell you that it's a very diverse population, and we're learning a lot, and we're working with the communities and the agencies who already provide care in the community. We're also working with Portico, if you're familiar with them, on that project. But I think that's a really good point. We can't lose sight of that.
Dr. Schofester again.
Thank you. One of the questions, one of the comments you made that I really agreed with is that one of the things that's going to happen with this and be an important part of it is the culture change. I think you were talking about the culture change more at the financial end and the data-driven end and making those kinds of decisions, but I also think there's a lot of culture change for the doc and whoever's working with them in this team to as they interact with each other and patients. What I'm interested in is what have you thought about or learned about the cost of that culture change and how do you account for it and deal with it and pay for it?
So many things. I was in a meeting recently where we were looking at the data on the Northwest Alliance Project and recognizing that we probably are not going to do very well in 2010. And someone in the room, and I'm pretty sure it was a physician, said, you know, I think we already succeeded because we have all of these smart people in a room talking about this. At least we're, you know, we're going down this path and we're talking about affordability and we're thinking about delivering care differently. And we needed to take on that risk just to even get there. There is a significant cost to this. These meetings that go on forever.
Not this one.
The kinds of tools that we have to buy, that we've been looking at all kinds of tools that would help be at the doctors, you know, to install onto our Epic system to help them make more real-time decisions that include affordability in their decision. So there's a real cost to this, culture change, and an emotional cost, too.
I'm going to try to just leave the brainstorming for next time.
Yeah, okay.
Actually, Michael Skandrat.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to follow up again on Senator Higgins' question, and I think there's a lot of new energy around accountable care organizations and healthcare homes, but there have, for several decades and more, been organizations who are very significantly at risk for the cost of care for a significant population of patients, and that's the uninsured patients. And, you know, they're very highly motivated to find ways to keep people healthy and avoid hospitalizations and so forth. So we'd like to probably bring some examples of some of that that occurs. You know, healthcare homes created out of necessity by a lot of safety net providers a long time ago and, you know, are doing that very well today and saving a lot of money, incidentally, mostly for payers, insurance companies, and the government, because they're not sharing in those savings themselves and are often making the investments in those programs out of the limited resources they have. So we'd like to an opportunity to talk to you more about that. So.
Representative
Mr. Chair, and just a comment, then I have a question, but to Senator Higgins, question there. One of the facts that is most impressed me in my 18 years here is that when they first started doing community measurement, the highest scores were the federally qualified health centers for diabetes. So somehow they had figured it out way ahead of other communities that had supposedly easier people to deal with. But my question is, you know, and you had that slide that had Mercy Hospital, Alina Medical Center, Health Partners. Have you run into any antitrust problems for these different groups that aren't under the same direction trying to share this kind of information? Is there anything that the state needs to do in the antitrust area to allow this?
Right. Well, I think that is unique, that situation, in that we have the health plan who employs the medical group, and then Alina, Mercy Hospital, and our medical group, you know, and then we have this one contract that includes it all. So we are fine with that. We have no antitrust issues, but I think certainly as we look at ACOs and how we might be taking risk together with non-employed providers. So we're looking at building what we call the Alina Integrated Clinically Integrated Network, or AIM. And this is so that we don't need to employ physicians and they don't want to be employed anyway, that we have a vehicle for them to be affiliated with us, and we could together have accountable care type contracts. And I do think we will be looking for, well, we are seeking guidance from antitrust lawyers, but we may be looking for more, you know, I don't know if I want to say exceptions, but I think it's going to be a struggle to navigate that.
If you could, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Hasbrook, if you could get us some information on that, because I think there, as we move towards accountable care organizations, particularly for the ones that are probably virtual,
right,
that they're not all in one organization, I do think there's probably going to be some antitrust problems that we would have to address as a state. And on your, I think it was your second to last slide, you said that the market needs a majority of payers on total cost of care contracts to provide common parameters such as risk adjusters, outlier definitions, and attribution methods. And do you think that the state should help set some of those? For instance, I think it was 3 years ago, we passed a law that said there had to be uniform billing by all the health insurance companies. And is there something that we could do as a state government to sort of simplify this so that the risk adjusters are the same for whatever insurance company you're dealing with? And I'd be interested in getting some information on that.
Well, you know, I think David talked about that just a little bit earlier, that we certainly don't want the attribution method that the provider peer grouping is using to be different than what we're using for another program with the state. So I think we want some consistency, but I don't know if I want to come out and say, well, I support the provider peer groupings methodology. So I do think we do need standardization. I'm reluctant to think that should be legislated. Or, you know, I don't know if that's something that we as a community should try to work through. I'm not sure.
Just respond on the uniform billing. The state had a committee that we appointed that spent 16 years, I think, discussing it, and it wasn't until the governor cracked the whip that they actually got to work.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hasbeck, and this is for you, but it also is a more general question for our group and other people who have presented today and last week as we go forward. We seem to have two competing and seemingly uncomplementary trends in my mind that have been going on for the last several years. We have this movement towards better care coordination in healthcare homes and trying, because the data all shows you that if you stay with one provider a long period of time, you're more likely to take better, you know, have better health outcomes and all kind of thing, and more vertical integration with these models. And then we have, on the other hand, Minute Clinics, Now Clinics, and now I have a new emergency clinic going in my community in Woodbury, kind of a quasi-emergency room. And it seems like, and moreover, we have health plans, including my state insurance plan, employee plan, incentivizing me to use the quick clinics rather than going to my long-term primary care provider. I pay much less money if I go for a flu or something to the quick clinic than if I go to my long-term 15-year physician who I see. So I'm undermining his model at the same time my insurance plan is incentivizing me to use something that provides no long-term perspective on my health. So either for you or others in this room as we go forward, I'm trying to understand where this parallel movement is fitting in with both the drive towards healthcare homes and better management, but also how that links to payment systems that we have. In terms of, are we incentivizing one thing on one hand, and on the other hand, we're, you know, incentivizing into something entirely different. So any comments, but it's really a broader set of questions for the group to maybe take up as we go on.
Ms. Halsberg?
Well, you know, I would say that it could be very complementary, actually. You know, there are services that Minute Clinic provides well and maybe should provide that we don't need to do at a clinic. But it gets to the coordination piece. And again, if I didn't know that that patient was my patient, they've gone to Minute Clinic for months and then saw them a couple times and now it's been attributed to me, 6 months later I find out, it's hard to get that coordination. So I think that some of these new models, you know, could really be complementary, but it'll be about how we coordinate that.
Yeah, and you know, I'm going to take a stab just on that same vein. And you know, the doctor that you've been seeing for 15 years, the model under which you would see him presumably would be to make a doctor's appointment with him to get your flu shot or something. And I don't think anybody would say that you need to go see your doctor, you know, and have one of your 15-minute visits that's attributed with that cost. But if you were in a healthcare home that was an integrated system of care and you could call a nurse and schedule to just stop by, you know, your healthcare home on your way to your office, it would be, you know, something akin to the cost associated with a Minute Clinic today. But, you know, we don't have that saturation of the market that we're talking about to have everybody that has these longstanding relationships able to navigate the world that has existed in an efficient manner. So, I mean, we're going through this growing pain, and Minute Clinics are certainly serving a niche right now. I mean, because again, nobody would say you would need to make your appointment, you know, 3 weeks out with your with your actual doctor to get a flu shot, or to even take a throat culture or something for, you know, I mean, I think, I don't know. That's, I'm just talking out loud here.
That is how I get my flu shot.
Dr. Ms. Elizabeth. Ms. Edwards.
Yes. Speaking from the world of pediatrics and experience with the medical home, this obviously retail-based clinics versus medical home can be seen as contrasting, but we've actually seen it as an opportunity to engage our patients and really work with them as partners to come to creative solutions such as were suggested, and to continue to look for that and actually strengthen that and have patients get to provide that information back to us. It's kind of like a sounding board to say, you know, you're not meeting our needs, right. And how can we work together to come to the solutions?
Yeah. All right. Well, I will say we've had mentioned already the endless meetings that we have around this, and it is my intention not to have endless meetings. I mentioned at the – so I'm going to bring this to a close rather quickly here. We mentioned at the beginning brainstorming on focusing what the work group should be doing. Maybe members can think about that in the interim here and come back with some more concrete ideas, because I do think that it is important that we start to refine – kind of what the work product should look like when we're done, but we kind of sprung this on folks, you know, 2 hours ago. So maybe go back and think about that a little bit, and maybe we'll have a more productive session next time. And I know that county-based purchasing asked if they could present next time. If other folks have experiences that they've had trying to get through some of the healthcare